Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. Now, as you know, the OMI in Bookomi stands for Original Memorable Insights. Yes, that's OMI, gleaned from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hi, I'm Leonard Mlodinow, author of Stephen Hawking, a memoir of friendship and physics. And this is my OMI for Bookomi.
The theoretical physicist, screenwriter, and best-selling author who spent the best part of two decades collaborating with the world's most famous scientist, Stephen Hawking.
Stephen was one of the greatest physicists of his generation. He did it by following his own passion, by not really listening to other people who told him that what he's thinking is a bad idea, and also by having a very unusual ability to contradict himself when he later saw that evidence was changing or not new way of looking at things and redoing something he had done earlier and taking things in a new direction.
Orbiting the genius and the tragedy of a man set high on a pedestal by his peers and the public, but physically diminished by a disease that left him at the mercy of everyone around him.
You think about your own life. It makes you appreciate what you have, that you can take a step, that you can speak, that the thoughts and ideas in your head, that they can come out of your head.
Leonard Mlodinow, welcome to Bookomi.
Thanks, Rich. Happy to be here.
Now, in retracing the arc of your relationship as it curved around the research and writing of your co-authored book, Grand Design, what did you learn about yourself, and did any new insights reveal themselves about your friend, Stephen Hawking?
Well, how much time do you have? Working with Stephen was an unbelievably intense and life-changing, enlightening, inspiring activity. It's hard to imagine what that's like for anyone who's only read his books or seen him on television, because the television interviews that he's on really are so staged and pre-canned, so to speak, that you don't get a real view. And that's one reason that I wrote the book, to see what his life was actually like. And to interact with him was really amazing. He, just to watch, for example, I describe in the book how a bead of sweat starts moving down his forehead. And for most of us, no problem. You raise your arm and you wipe it off. But you know how that can just tickle, and it's like Chinese water torture. And if you can't do that, you have to sit and you have to endure that. You have to be able to take your mind off it as it slowly, slowly goes down. And many other bodily events happen that are similar. Even for him to sleep, for example, everyone turns at some point during sleep. Otherwise, you get aches and pains. Well, he doesn't turn. He can't turn. He had carers who would stay with him all night and turn him periodically. But that doesn't mean that when he was uncomfortable, that they would be right on the job doing it. They did it on a certain schedule. Nor could he request it, because when he's sleeping, he's disconnected from his communications. So when I came in to work with him every day, I would see him around noon or 1 o'clock. And that's not because he, like me, likes to sleep in. It's because he has a whole long morning routine just to make him able to face life and to have his medical needs met. So when you work with somebody like that and you really see it day to day, minute by minute, you see how hard it is for him to communicate, how if he just wants to say something simple, it comes out about 6 words a minute. It can take him 10, 20 minutes to say something that you would knock off very quickly. And how much effort that takes, and how much steel he had in his soul to be able to continually do that, to communicate with you and not just give up and say, I just don't want to talk about it. It's too hard to talk. You think about your own life. It makes you appreciate what you have, that you can take a step, that you can speak, that the thoughts and ideas in your head, that they can come out of your head. It makes your problems seem small. If you think, oh, I have a headache, woe is me, or I don't know, I lost $1,000 on the stock market, or my car broke down, or whatever the everyday problem of life is. And then when you're working with him, that it really puts things in perspective. You realize what a gift good health is, the ability to communicate, to move, to get things for yourself, to take care of yourself, not to have other people have to help you for all kinds of bodily needs where you might not want someone else present. I mean, it's just amazing that he could go through that, not only with the fortitude to not complain, but to have a good outlook and a great, you know, famous sense of humor. It was really amazing. And I, you know, still when I think about it to these days, it's inspirational.
We'll get onto the sense of humor in a minute, but you mentioned close up there, and that's the experience of the book and the new insight I had. You as a screenwriter, you can tell, you know, as well as being a theoretical physicist, you're a screenwriter, and you had a real way in the book of creating the scene and that close up. Literally, you're physically close up because you had to be close to him to work with him physically as well as emotionally. But that moment where you describe the, you know, the bead of sweat turning into a liquid ball rolling down his chin, and whether or not you should move in. And there's some, oddly, some comedy in there as well, because the first time that you did make the move to help him out, it sort of backfired a bit, didn't it, physically?
Yeah, I had been left alone, which is, in the beginning, was very unusual, but his carer had to go to the loo. She left me with him for just a minute, and when I reached over to dab that that bead of sweat, his wasn't quite gentle enough, and his head flopped over. And he, you know, he does not have, of course, the ability to hold his head up, and you can imagine how painful that is if his head is just flopping around. And so I started to try to set it up, and then one thing led to another, and he had an alarm on his glasses for when they were out of position. That went off and started buzzing, and I think, oh my God, I've been nabbed damaging Stephen Hawking. And people started running in, what's going on? What's going on?
Don't damage Stephen Hawking.
Oh, yeah, that was, you know, early on, I'm working with him there, yes.
Well, why were his theories so important to the scientific community and our understanding of the universe? Was he the Einstein of his generation?
Well, that's just as in his personal life, I wrote the book to portray what he was really like rather than the somewhat idealized or mythological Stephen. I also wanted to do that for his physics. And he wasn't an Einstein, and that's okay. And he knew it, and he would laugh about it when people called him that. You know, he could be a great religious leader. You don't have to be Jesus. You know? And in fact, I wrote about it early. He used to go to Caltech, where I was on the faculty. He used to go to Caltech for about 4 decades, once a year for several weeks or a month or even 6 weeks. And when he started going in the 70s, I said in the book, not only was he not the greatest physicist in the world, but he would have come in number three on the fourth floor of Lauridsen Lab in his degree of influence behind the greats Murray Gell-Mann and Richard Feynman, who were there. So that's really not the issue, though. I mean, but was he extremely influential, great physicist? Yes, I think he deserved a Nobel Prize. You know, he didn't get it for reasons we can talk about if you want, but it's basically, you don't get it for theory. There has to be experimental observations that go with it. But he had an enormous influence on physics. Einstein basically took apart physics and rebuilt it. He was on the level with Newton. Stephen was one of the greatest physicists of his generation. And what he really did was, he did it by following his own passion, by not really listening to other people who told him that what he's thinking is a bad idea, and also by having a very unusual ability to contradict himself when he later saw that evidence was changing or a new way of looking at things and redoing something he had done earlier and taking things in a new direction. So what he really did was to take, along with a few others like Roger Penrose, but he was really the leader, I would say. He took a field that was a sleepy field that not many people worked on, and people said the best physicists did not go into that field in the 1960s, which is black holes and the early beginning of the universe. And he made it not only respectable, but really one of the hottest fields in physics. And he did that really through his work and through the power of his physics and his personality. People did not appreciate those fields early on because physics, like all science, is experimental and observation-based. And people thought, you're never going to see a black hole. They're, whoever they, if they do exist, they're who knows where. And of course, they don't shine, so it's hard to find them. You have to use indirect means of finding them. And they also thought that we could not see back in time far enough by looking at ancient starlight to see the early universe. So why really investigate these things? And Stephen didn't accept that. He saw that just by studying those phenomena based on the existing theories of physics, you could illuminate not just those phenomena, but important qualities of the theories of physics. So he started in the 1960s doing that, by studying black holes and the early universe. And through a series of great bodies of work, he really changed the way people think about not just those fields, but about general relativity, which is Einstein's theory of gravity, and about quantum theory, and how you might, those two theories contradict each other. They still do today. We don't really know how to unify them, but Stephen showed that you could use a little bit of one and a little bit of the other if you do it carefully and apply them to the same situation in harmony and learn a lot about both theories.
In the writing of The Grand Design, and as it progresses, you get closer into the circle of trust around him, and you venture to ask about his disability and its effect on his career and his thinking. You worry that you've overstepped the mark, but his response surprises you. What did he say?
Well, first thing he said was he thought it was a positive. And that's Stephen for you. I mean, they say glass half empty or half full. Stephen had a glass that had about one drop of water in it. He said, oh, it's almost full. So, I mean, he really had an amazingly positive outlook. And what he told me was that in his younger days, and he did get this in his early 20s, but when he was still at college at Oxford, he was somewhat aimless and didn't do a lot of work and had no real interest in life. And when he got to Cambridge, it was also a bit like that. And it was his disability that gave him a purpose. It made him ask certain questions. What is life about? Why am I here? Why are we here? These are the questions that he kept trying to answer with his physics. Why is the universe like this? Why are we here? And what's our role in it? And then he realized while he was there that if he had anything he could do with the rest of his years, he wanted to do something constructive. And those were the questions that he wanted to devote himself to. And the disability not only gave him that realization, but also in taking away a large element of the social aspect, the partying that he used to like to do and the going out with friends, which just became much harder and not something that he did as much, helped him to focus on physics. I read a study once that said that, you know, the stereotype of physicists is that they're somewhat Asperger-ish or antisocial or asocial, if not antisocial. They kind of introverts keep to themselves. And the study concluded that physicists tend to be, there's something to that, they tend to be more like that because it takes such immense concentration and dedication to get anywhere in theoretical physics, that if you weren't like that, you wouldn't make a lot of progress. And Stephen had that in a way given to him by his disability. So that was really the essence of his answer. There's more to it I can go into if you want later, but for instance, how he had to restructure the way he did physics because he couldn't use the blackboard or a pad and paper. He had to do it in his head. So he went to a more geometrical approach. And so other things that he did to adapt. He was a great adapter, not only in his personal life, but he was an adapter in physics. As I said, when a theory comes along and shows that there's another way of looking at something, he could adapt his way of looking and go with it. And that was a great strength. And it was also in his personal life.
And in The Grand Design, the book that you painstakingly co-wrote with him, it deals with the biggest themes imaginable, the origins and scientific laws of the universe and the existence of God. And yet the micro moments, the mopping up of food and drink from his chin, the tenderness of holding a hand, or the loneliness late at night that you sense, are what I feel give the book its meaningful context, oddly, that of human love and compassion. Would you agree, or is that just the sort of romantic nonsense reserved for non-scientists?
No, I agree. I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't think that was the point, because I didn't set out to write a book to explain physics. I explained the physics that he did in the service of putting his career in context. But the book is really about him as a person and these lessons that you learn and the feelings that you experience, such as you say, the late night loneliness, the going to his house for dinner every evening to keep him company, just because I think he had those lonely moments because, unlike you and I, he can't just pick up the phone and call someone or say, hey, let's meet for a beer. All these things that for us are very simple are big undertakings for him. Not that he never did them, but they are big undertakings and he don't do it lightly or casually. And he really enjoyed having company, and those nights sitting around having dinner or watching TV afterwards were really touching for me, and how we started to bond in a personal way.
And your conversations and your debates had to take place, like you say, through the prism of his disability. There was no idle chatter, and having worked so hard to get them out, he didn't waste his words, really, which made lots of people think he was maybe being abrupt or cutting or sharp, but it's just a different way of communicating. Did this make you personally think and work in a different way? Did it bend your communication methods and skills?
Well, you know, when I so he first contacted me, he had read my first book, Euclid Window, and then Feynman's Rainbow, which is a memoir about this famous physicist from Caltech, Richard Feynman, who really changed the world of physics himself. And we started communicating by email. And by email, just as by text, you don't have the nonverbal communication. And so things can seem abrupt. It's hard to tell what someone means. And he can seem terse because given that he was typing 6 words a minute using the machine that he could type with that would help him get composed the words, he didn't want to waste sentences with niceties. And when you first meet him, it's a similar. He's very brief. And it can be a bit jarring in that you don't really, you're trying to figure out what is he thinking, or, you know, if the nicety is not there, does that mean he's not feeling warmly toward you? Or you can ask yourself these questions. But as you get to know him, you realize that that's not it. You understand where it's coming from, but also you start to learn and a new way of communication that he has developed, which is a nonverbal communication using his face, because he did still have use of his facial muscles. And what would happen is you learn to read his face in a way that I never do with anybody else. It's really weird. I would sometimes just know what he was thinking by looking at him. I wouldn't even realize what it was he was doing in his face exactly. Probably some subtle musculature that he was manipulating, but you would get the point. And those who are close to him, who were close to him, all said the same thing, that he had an amazing ability for nonverbal communication. So the words were more like the spice, and the meat sometimes was just the looks that he would give you. And some of them were, I have to say, really fierce and exaggerated too. I mean, if he really liked something or thought something was funny, that would be a big, you know, like a smile that is almost like a caricature. And he had a tremendous frown if he got annoyed with you, and his eyes could move around. And I mean, it was really interesting, but powerful. And so after a while, you get on the same wavelength with him, and then you start to communicate just like any people. You almost forget, other than the time taking longer, you almost forget that you're doing this in a non-standard way.
Well, given his work on time and its relative position in space, it's interesting that you get into a different, literally a different time zone, a different way of doing things. And let's talk about the social universe around your friend, Stephen Hawking. You say that as you spent more time with him, I was noticing how much he was at the mercy of those who surrounded him. And at one point in your conversations with him, his carers, of which there are many, Patrick and Dawn, start arguing amongst themselves about who's going on a trip. And you describe it as a theater among his carers, like a private soap opera. He was obviously observing this with those very expressive eyes and you know, his ability to just observe everything. Did you feel protective of him in the presence of all these vested interests, or did you become a character in the soap opera yourself?
Well, I did my best not to become a character in the soap opera, but I wouldn't say I felt protective either. At the beginning, I would feel, when I was first working with him in Cambridge, I would feel somewhat protective. But I soon learned that he didn't need any protection, and quite the opposite. He really could take care of himself. And his relationship with the carers were interesting. They were different with each one. They all had different approaches toward him. Some would be more babying toward him. Some would be more flirtatious. Some would just be more objective, less emotional. And he had his own personal relationship with each of them and took a great interest in them. He sometimes lent them money or went to their family gatherings. And for him, they were like an extended family. But amongst them, there was a lot of jockeying for position at times. For instance, these foreign trips were something they all liked to go on because they got more money for them. They were usually to nice places. And it was, of course, that Stephen would have to pay their travel and their lodging. And so when they weren't working, they could see the town where they were in. And it was a bit political who got picked to go on which trip, since, you know, he had a 10 to 12 carers at any given time, and he might take 5, 6, 7 on a trip, you know, for his round the clock care. And he enjoyed watching the interrelationships between the carers. I mean, it was, I think, a kind of entertainment for him. Don't mean that in a mean way. It was almost in a affectionate way, but in the way that a parent might look at the children who are arguing about something and just think it's cute, you know, or something like that. Yeah, yeah. He could have ended some of those discussions by saying so-and-so, you know, this is who's going, but he would just watch them and take it in. And for the carers, he was also their theater. So it worked both ways.
And his second wife, Elaine, I think cuts a sorry figure in the book. And although rumours of mistreatment were flatly denied by him, she seems to have a motive for revenge, referring to herself, when you spoke to her, as his slave for 20 years, a nothing, a nobody, invisible like the air, saying that Stephen needed to be the centre of the universe. And they divorced in 2006 when he was 65. And he became, as you describe him, a single atom floating unbonded through the lonely vacuum of space, which is incredible, an incredible way to describe someone and after they've separated. What was your perspective on that? I mean, you were really close up. You saw that situation, those relationships close up. And you used the phrase, he could take care of himself. That's an incredible phrase to use for somebody who was dependent on so many people. Was he ever at risk from those around him, do you think?
I really never formed an opinion on the accusations about Elaine. And so I in the book, I describe what different people said, and the police found eventually after an investigation that there was nothing to the accusations. So I don't really know about that, but I did observe Elaine and knew her a little bit, and I could observe their relationship. And I also could observe, talk to him about her at times, you know, when she wasn't present. I know he was extremely attached to her and they had a very stormy relationship, and everybody around him knew that. It was extreme passion. At one moment, it was some arguing or disagreement the next moment, which is not that unusual in relationships. But I know that even after their divorce, he was extremely attached to her and extremely distraught by the divorce and their splitting up.
And when people are living in a microscope like that, you know, like you say, all relationships have their extreme ups and downs, don't they?
They do. But, you know, there's a scene in the book where I am talking to Stephen about life, and I had had a scare, my own brush with death. And I was thinking at that time, wow, how stupidly ironic it would be if I died before he did. But on the other hand, I really thought he was immortal and would never die. But we started talking about life and what the meaning of life is. And at one point I thought, well, you know, I know that you have all these brushes with deaths, and then when you just get back to it, you get back to your physics. And so physics is life, isn't it? And his reply was really amazing and reminded me again that he's not just a very influential and outstanding physicist, but as a human being, because he said, no, love is life. So, you know, even a guy who is so dedicated to his subject, who spends so much time immersed in his own brain and in equations rather than interacting with people, and who has such a trouble having interactions with people because he can't have physical interactions, to him, it's still all about love.
And he was brilliant and brave, as you describe him, but he was, as you say, vulnerable, and it made you vulnerable too. The chaos and the confusion and disruption was everywhere and inconsistent, like when he made you ask the literary agent to go for more money from the publisher, asking Al Zuckerman for more money for the Grand Design book. You described that brilliantly, which was published in 2010. And you described this very awkward scene where you're having to sit there and say, well, that's what he wants. He wants more money. And it, morally, you thought that was a little bit, you thought it was wrong. You thought it wasn't the way of that universe. But as with anything, he bent that universe to his will, didn't he?
He sure did. Yeah, he decided at some point that he didn't like the advance we got and he wanted it doubled. And I was in Cambridge with him heading back to California with a stop in New York. And so he said, I want you, Al Zuckerman was his agent. And he said, I want you to go see Al and tell him I want to double the advance. So I went to see Al with my agent. Susan Ginsberg came with me and we had a little powwow. And Al, of course, Al was a very highly respected old school publishing guy who's been around forever and does things the right way, and it's a business of handshakes and trust. But in this case, it was beyond that because we even had a signed contract. And here I am having to tell Al that we want to go back on and demand that we amend the contract and double it. And, you know, Al was flabbergasted and was telling me that, no one does such things. They'll never do it. They're, you know, and I'm saying, this is Stephen Hall, you know, He wants it. And then Al's saying, well, it doesn't matter because you'll get the royalties anyway. So it doesn't matter what your advance is. They'll pay it to you when the royalties come. So the advance is just an advance, but the royalties will go beyond that, which they actually did by quite a bit. So still I'm saying, I'm just, you know, this is what Stephen said. And then Al was very reluctant. And then at one point I said, Well, I have to share with you something that, that Steven said. He said, if Al doesn't want to do it, then bugger Al. And I didn't want to say that because Al Zuckerman is the man who made Stephen Hawking. If you read the book and I give you his history, Al Zuckerman found Stephen Hawking where he was an obscure, unknown person outside of physics. He was working on a book that was going to be published by Cambridge University Press, probably not sell more than 10,000 copies in its lifetime. His advance was $25,000 for it. And he didn't have a contract yet, but he was, they were working up the contract, and that was the plan. And his first draft of that book, A Brief History of Time, was not very good. It was very dry, technical. It in parts was talking to people as if they're kids, other parts as if they're graduate students. And it wasn't in great shape. It needed a lot of work, and Cambridge University Press would not have been up to doing that work. And Al read an article about Stephen in the New York Times and contacted him, plucked that book away from the Cambridge University Press, got Bantam to buy it for 10 times as much money, which was a huge amount back in the 80s for an unknown author, and assigned a great, brilliant guy to be an editor, Peter Guzzardi, to help Stephen rewrite the book and make it what it ended up being. And Al had been his agent for the next, whatever that was, 30, 40 years after that. So when he says, if he doesn't like it, bugger Al, that was quite a, I think, hurtful statement. But, you know, Al's been around and he took it well. He thought about it for a minute and then he just said, I've been called worse. And then he went to Bantam and he said, hey, sorry, I know this is not done, but, you know, Stephen wants to double the advance. And they said, fine. And that, when I went back to tell Stephen that the next time I was there to talk to him about it, it was like nothing. It wasn't even, there was no surprise, no celebration, no, oh, okay, good. You know, it was like he has had assumed from the start that that's what would happen. So.
Did you find him infuriating at times? Because obviously when you first met, he was already well known and you had preconceptions and you were very gentle and apprehensive in your approach and it took time to get to know each other. But eventually, especially with the toing and froing of the collaborative nature of writing The Grand Design, your patience was stretched, wasn't it? And you started seeing him as a friend, but also as someone who needed to be pulled up from time to time.
It was extremely frustrating at times, maybe sometimes infuriating, but quite often frustrating. You know, for example, Stephen would usually leave his door open. So I'm working with him and his door's open. People would pop in. So I would come from California and have a week or 2 weeks with him to do some intense work. And he was wonderful about clearing his schedule for me. And so we could get a lot done. And people would come in, pop in, interrupt us. And he would normally be open to whatever, if someone comes in and then I'm just sitting there for 20 minutes while they discuss something and then they would leave. They'd always come in and go, oh, Leonard, excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt. This will take 1 minute. It never did.
Yeah.
And, or also his, he was extremely an extreme perfectionist. So the way we wrote the book was we first, in great detail over a year, talked about the organization of the contents. And then we started writing, we split up which sections each of us writes. Then we would trade and he would comment on my sections, I would comment on his sections. And then we would rewrite or I would rewrite his sections. He would comment on mine, I would rewrite those based on that. Some of it was done by email. A lot of it was done in Cambridge or when he came to Caltech. As I said, usually about 3 to 6 weeks each year, we would work there intensely the whole time. In the end, you couldn't tell who wrote what because he had his fingers and his hands over every word. I mean, for someone who has to struggle to spend maybe 5 minutes to say a couple sentences, no detail was too small for him to say, he could say, I don't, you know, we would argue about a word. I mean, sometimes we'd argue about concepts. Sometimes we argued about words or phrasings or, you know, statements that we would make. And we would talk about the illustrations in great detail. He would comment on very minute things of, you know, aspects of the illustrations that were going to go into the book. And then I had to go back to the artist and talk to him. It was, he was really quite down to the last letter. And at times it was hard because we had, you know, we were way behind. It took us 4 years to do the writing instead of, I don't remember, a year and a half that we were supposed to. And we had big issues to talk about, and we'd end up spending a whole afternoon dwelling on a paragraph. So, but that's the way it went. And in the end, the punchline to all that is, in the end, there's a story in the book about our final deadline when Bantam just, I guess, gave up and announced it's coming out, set a date, didn't even tell us in advance. And then we're just supposed to make it the book by a certain date so they could make the release by the other date. And we're working up, and that last day, we're still talking about things. He still has seen, he's going on and on for a very long day. And again, even on some minor details, even the minor detail of one of the illustrations. And our deadline was 8 p.m. Cambridge time, and it was a Friday night. And as we're getting to 8 p.m., it's clear that we're not going to finish this stuff by then. And Judith is there, his assistant, who was wonderful this whole time and who held my hand through a lot of it. And I'm going, oh my God, you got to change my flights. I'm going to stay a few more days. We're not making the deadline again. Well, this is horrible. And I walk in, and he gives me his latest thing. And then I say, okay, the next, what about this? And now it's 8 o'clock. And he just goes, it's 8 o'clock. We're done. The book is done. And so he just like dropped everything. And then I'm looking at him like, what, you know? And he just says, sometimes I need a deadline to get me to do something. There you go. Then I'm like kicking myself. Why didn't we, you know, I should have told Bantam to do this 2 years ago.
Well, you live and learn. You live and learn, Leonard. Stephen Hawking died on March the 14th, 2018. How do you think his work will, I mean, you've described him in a whole new dimension in the book, but how do you think his work will be remembered in March 2118? How pleased are you that you have, along with your own work, brought us closer to an understanding of the universe, his universe, through his mind? Do you think it will endure, or do you think we're accelerating now so quickly that there'll never be another Stephen Hawking?
Well, his work will endure in the physics world. I know that people outside of the physics world tend not to know the greatest physicists of any generation except for a couple of the century. So when you look back 100 years ago, I can name two dozen great physicists from those days that had huge influence that you never heard of probably. And so I think that's the fate of all physicists, but his work in physics will endure because physicists will know what Stephen Hawking did, because his work on the intersection of quantum theory and general relativity, his work on trying to understand, to create a quantum theory of gravity, which was what led to his black holes, work on the black hole radiation and the information paradox that grew from that. That's something that people, even if it's not and probably won't be something of current interest 100 years from now, I would hope, because we would no longer have those two separate theories, but we would have made a lot more progress towards a unified theory that encompasses both of them. And people will look back and go, but in the old days when Einstein came up with general relativity and these other guys came up with quantum theory, oh, how interesting it was that physicists didn't know how to combine them, and now we do. And when they say that, and they look back at the physicists who were trying to learn how to combine them, he will be probably the number one or two in that group. So I think his name will, and the name of, and the term Hawking radiation will endure. But again, in 100 years, my God, change in this, I wrote a book about this, Elastic. Change in the world is accelerating, and a lot of it's driven by the exponential growth in our knowledge. And 100 years from now, today is going to be equal to, I'm sure, more than the time between Newton and today in terms of scientific achievement. So who knows where we'll be 100 years from now if humanity's still here.
Yeah, well, God only knows. And as we know, with scientific laws, and a unified theory, then God's not necessary. So God knows what's necessary after that. It's mind-boggling. Leonard, as it was a privilege for you to spend so much time making history with your friend Stephen Hawking, it's been our privilege to share some of that time, briefly, that human history, today. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bookomi.
Thank you, Rich. Great questions. I appreciate it.
Leonard Mlodinow's book, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bookomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, and when pondering the mysteries of the universe, remember what Stephen Hawking said: love is life. Bye for now.